This week, something that not very many people go in for, writing the lives of great philosophers. We meet one of the foremost practitioners of the art. Hi, and welcome to the Philosopher's Zone. I'm Alan Saunders. There's a school of thought which has it that what matters about philosophers is their philosophy. After all, if you're a logician, who cares what you do with your downtime between proving theorems? Does it help, for example, to know this about the childhood of the great philosopher Bertrand Russell?
I suppose my very earliest memory is tumbling out of a pony carriage when I was 2 years old. And my earliest at all vivid memories are of arriving at the house of my grandparents, Pembroke Lodge in Richmond Park, after the death of my father, who died when I was three.
How did you come to be in the care of your grandparents? Your mother had also died?
Yes, she also. She died when I was two and my father when I was three.
What were the first books that impressed you? For instance, were you interested in history, in fairy stories, in adventure, or what?
Oh, I was always very much interested in history, very much. Fairy stories when I was younger, yes. And I regret to say that I liked Hans Andersen much better than Grimm. I don't now, but I did then, very much better. I read Hans Andersen's fairy tales over and over again when I was young.
Were you always a sceptic from small childhood, or did you believe in the conventions of
fairy tales? Oh, I wasn't a sceptic when I was very young, no. I was very deeply religious and lost my conventional beliefs slowly and painfully. Very slowly, I remember it now. This is another very early memory that I have, that when I was 4 years old, they'd just been telling me the story of Little Red Riding Hood, and I dreamt that I'd been eaten by a wolf, and to my great surprise, I was in the wolf's stomach and not in heaven.
Ray Monk, Professor of Philosophy at the University of Southampton, would not agree that the biography doesn't matter. He's the biographer of two of the greatest philosophers of the 20th century, not just Russell, but also Ludwig Wittgenstein. And when he joined me from the UK, I wanted to begin at the end. Last week, when I spoke to Alexander Waugh about his book on the troubled Wittgenstein clan, I asked him about Wittgenstein's last words, "Tell them I've had a wonderful life." And Waugh cited Nietzsche to the effect that the deathbed is a place for showing off and pretense. Does Ray Monk think that's fair?
No, I don't think he was pretending. I think always you have to bear in mind that people say things in a context to a particular group of people. I don't think you can simply take that remark as, you know, Wittgenstein insisting on the happiness of his life. Rather than see it as an attempt to mislead or show off or anything, I think it's better, if anything, to see it as a form of politeness. It was, you know, trying to say to these friends who he knew would be upset at his passing, trying to say to them, look, don't be upset. My life has been a happy one.
You've got us now straight into the question of context. Philosophers in the English language used to be known, perhaps they still are, for treating the glorious dead, Plato, Descartes, Kant and so on, as contemporaries to be engaged with and possibly even marked out of 10. They haven't seen these people in their historical context. Now, this makes for a tradition, a philosophical tradition, that's not very friendly to biography, is it?
I think that's right, yeah. Particularly the analytic tradition tends to look askance at any... They're not very interested in the history of philosophy or putting philosophers in their historical context, and I think for most of them it goes without saying that nothing about the life of a philosopher could shed any light on the value of their thought.
Well, it is true, though, isn't it, that we don't need to know about the life of Descartes to understand and certainly not to evaluate his Meditations, do we?
Yeah, of course. And nothing in the life of Russell is going to tell you whether the proofs in Principia Mathematica are valid or not. But I think there is a role for biography, and it doesn't come into the evaluation of arguments, because whether an argument is valid or not, of course, does not depend on any fact about the person putting the argument forward. But I think there's a more fine-grained level at which, you know, to understand somebody to understand their utterances, you need to understand, as it were, the tone of their voice. An example might be if somebody says that there's a mouse in this room, depending on how they say it, you know, that could be an expression of alarm. It could be an expression of interest. Somebody might like mice. It could be an expression of delight. To hear it as delight or fear is not to understand the words used in the sentence, but to understand the tone in which they're being used. And I think that's something like what happens when, with a philosopher like Wittgenstein, you need to know often, you know, is he saying what he's saying in a sarcastic voice, in a matter-of-fact voice? This is particularly so in the later work, in Philosophical Investigations, where there are quite clearly a number of different voices going on. So you need to be sensitive to the tone and sensitive to what Wittgenstein himself called the spirit in which he wrote. And I think that's where the role for biography comes. It would vary in importance from philosopher to philosopher. I mean, I've read a number of Lives of Immanuel Kant, and I don't think I've learnt much from... I mean, I found them very interesting, but I don't think they've changed the way I see the Critique of Pure Reason. Whereas I think a lot of misunderstandings of Wittgenstein come from not understanding the spirit in which he wrote. And I think he was very well aware of that, and he tried to correct it in a number of prefaces that he wrote for his work, particularly in the 30s and 40s.
Yes, you mention Immanuel Kant. I was going to mention the great American philosopher and logician Willard Van Orman Quine. Quine wrote an autobiography, but I don't think anybody has ever thought of that as a way into his philosophy.
No, a friend of mine once said that Quine's autobiography should have been titled Portions of Space-Time I Have Inhabited.
It's interesting, though, that you talk about the need for sensitivity, particularly with the case of Wittgenstein, to the tone with which an utterance is being made, because that seems to me to relate to an important issue. As somebody who talks about philosophy on the radio, I often find that it's not always that difficult to explain what philosophers have said about one or another issue. The really difficult thing is to explain why anybody would bother saying it.
That's a very good point. Yeah.
You need to get some idea of why this matters to somebody, don't you?
Absolutely, and I think that's particularly so with Wittgenstein. Wittgenstein once began a series of lectures by echoing what you've just said. The very first words he said in lecture one were something like, look, what I'm about to say will be very easy to understand. What will be difficult to understand is why I'm saying it. And, with a lot of things in the later philosophy, the slogan, the meaning of the sentence is the use to which it's put. Well, you want to know, well, whoever thought otherwise, and why is this worth saying, and what philosophical mistakes does reminding yourself of that correct, and so on and so on. So, yes, I think to understand Wittgenstein's later work is to understand why he's saying what he's saying, and that requires some context, and it requires some understanding, as I said before, of the spirit of Wittgenstein. One example of this, one glaring example, is the early work, Tractatus Logico-Philosophicus, which was understood by many, including some members of the Vienna Circle, as expressing a logical positivist point of view, according to which philosophy is restricted to analysing the statements of science, and any attempt to talk about ethics or aesthetics or the meaning of life or religion must be, condemned as nonsense, fit only for the metaphysical waste paper basket, as it were. Now, you can see how the view that Wittgenstein puts in Tractatus Logico-Philosophicus could fit into that, but anybody who understood Wittgenstein at all would see that his attitude to those things is completely opposite to the logical positivists. So Tractatus Logico-Philosophicus ends with the remark, whereof one cannot speak, thereof one must be silent. And the difference, one could say, between Wittgenstein and logical positivists is that for Wittgenstein, one is being silent about a great deal. For the logical positivists, one of them once said, we must indeed be silent, but not about anything.
Yes. You began your work on Wittgenstein at a point in his work where we really don't expect biography to emerge. You began with the philosophy of mathematics.
Yes.
How did you get from there to writing his biography?
Well, strangely enough, it's particularly in the philosophy of mathematics that an understanding of Wittgenstein himself is particularly important for understanding his work. Yes, I, as you say, my graduate work was in the Wittgenstein's philosophy of mathematics, and at that time the two most influential commentators on that portion of Wittgenstein's work were Michael Dummett and Crispin Wright, both of whom had written a great deal of very subtle and very important work, generally in philosophy, but also particularly on Wittgenstein. But I thought that both of them had misunderstood Wittgenstein in a similar kind of way. That's to say, if they understood Wittgenstein, if they understood the person, they would not have attributed, you know, that view. In Crispin Wright's case, he attributed a view called strict finitism to Wittgenstein. And nobody who understood Wittgenstein would attribute that to him. So it seemed to me that one way of correcting prevalent misunderstandings of Wittgenstein's philosophy of mathematics would be to say, yes, but look, here's the kind of person Wittgenstein was, and now don't you see that this view doesn't fit with that person? Just like once you understand the reverence that he had for mysticism and religion, you can see that, you know, attributing logical positivism to him would be a fundamental mistake.
I suppose something, I don't want to speak for Crispin Wright here, but I suppose something he might say is, well, yes, what you say is true, but that's not the point. The point I am making is that Wittgenstein's work will bear this interpretation, and whether or not he meant that interpretation really is none of my business, any more than it's my business if I'm dealing with a strict mathematician, if his theorems have consequences that he didn't want. Well, tough, that's theorems for you.
Yeah, that's right, and that's the kind of thing people do say, and there's something in that. I mean, you know, Crispin Wright's analysis of strict finitism don't in any way depend upon his understanding or not understanding Wittgenstein as a man. However, he's attributing strict finitism to Wittgenstein. I mean, it would be fine if he said, look, you know, here's a view, strict finitism, and now I'm going to discuss it, point out problems with it, and so on and so on. That would be, you know, perfectly fine thing to do. But he's attributing that to Wittgenstein, and then it seems to me, well, now you've got to care about whether you're right to attribute it to Wittgenstein.
In fact, you think, don't you, that there's something peculiarly Wittgensteinian about biography as a genre?
I do. I think that the kind of understanding that Wittgenstein held to be central to philosophy is precisely the kind of understanding that a biographer is aspiring to achieve. Wittgenstein said that the kind of understanding that he was looking for in philosophy is what he called the kind of understanding that consists in seeing connections. And he contrasted that with theoretical understanding. So always in Wittgenstein, he was contrasting what he did with what scientists do. Scientists construct theories, and he thought it was no part of the philosopher's task to construct a theory. Theories enable us to understand certain phenomena and so on and so on. But he said, in philosophy, we're not striving for a theory. Philosophy is not science. What philosophy tries to do is achieve an understanding that is fundamentally non-theoretical, and it's the kind of understanding you might have of a poem or a piece of music or indeed of a person.
So when you talk about drawing out connections, that's not equivalent to making claims about connections, making falsifiable claims or verifiable claims about the truth of things.
No, it's not. It's more akin to, you know, I'll show you two photographs. Here's a photograph of a girl and here's a photograph of her mother. And now can you see the connection between the two? Now, the connection is not, as it were, some third thing that you see. You're seeing the mother and the daughter in some kind of connection. You're seeing one in terms of the other and so on. Wittgenstein was fascinated by that particular kind of example, the Galtonian photograph. The scientist Galton used to take photographs of family members and superimpose them one on top of another so that you could see the similarities and dissimilarities in the structure of the face, the nose, the eyes, and so on. Wittgenstein was so fascinated by this, he had a Galtonian photograph made of himself with his siblings, and it's the weirdest picture you've ever seen, but you can, you know, see the connections between him and his sister, the differences between him and his brother, and so on and so on. And that kind of, you might call it perceptual understanding, is what Wittgenstein thought was central to philosophy. And he often said that it was the kind of understanding one has of a person, and therefore it seems to me the kind of understanding that a biographer is trying to achieve. Now, if you think of biography, the best biographies are not those that, as it were, put forward a hypothesis and then try to establish that hypothesis. That's not the format that a good biography can take. If you think of Boswell on Johnson, or Richard Ellman on Oscar Wilde, the form it takes is not assertoric. It's, you know, the skill of a biographer is quotation. So Boswell's book of Johnson works by just endlessly quoting Johnson, so that you get, by the time you finish the book, you feel as if you've heard Johnson's voice. You know what kind of man he was. You know how he might react to this or that or the other. And the same with Ellman on Oscar Wilde. The skill is quite different from the skill of writing a scientific paper. You're building up a picture. You're allowing your reader to, as it were, see the connections, to put the things together. I remember there was a biography of Virginia Woolf that I once read that is a good example of how not to do this. And the biographer quoted a letter from Virginia to Leonard Woolf just before they got married. And Virginia Woolf said to Leonard, I feel no sexual attraction towards you. And the next paragraph began, here, Virginia is telling Leonard she feels no sexual attraction towards him. And you think, well, that's how not to do it. If you look at the great biographers like Boswell or Ellman, they don't do what academics tend to do, which is quote something and then devote the next paragraph to telling you what the quotation says. That's not the art of biography. The art of biography is to quote something and then produce something else for you to see that quotation in a context.
You're not the only philosopher to write biography. Jean-Paul Sartre wrote Lives of Baudelaire, Genet and Flaubert. From what you've written about him, I gather you think he's doing exactly what you think biographers ought not to do. He is asserting a theory.
I think that's right. In different ways in those three books you mention. I mean, his book on Baudelaire is rather short. His book on Flaubert is, you know, multi-volumed. He never finished it, and it's completely unreadable. But yes, there's a similar mistake here. Take the Baudelaire case. Sartre wrote that as putting into practice a theory. Sartre's theory at that time was that we choose to become the people we are, so that the task of the biographer is to locate and identify the moment when we choose to be who we are. And so, you know, what he does in Baudelaire's case is he says, this is the moment when Baudelaire chose to become Baudelaire. You know, that's an interesting idea, and one could perhaps learn something from it, but it doesn't result in a good biography, precisely because it's not Baudelaire's voice we're hearing there. It's Sartre's voice telling us Sartre's theories. And so you come away from the book feeling as if you might have understood Sartre's theories better, but what you don't feel you've done is something analogous to what you feel when you've read Boswell's Johnson. You don't feel, as it were, as if you've met Baudelaire. You don't feel as if, you know, you know what kind of person he was. And the same thing about Sartre's sprawling book on Flaubert, which again he wrote to prove a point. What he was trying to show in that book was that a complete understanding of somebody is possible, and a complete understanding is possible of somebody by bringing in history, sociology, political theory, philosophical psychology. You have sections of the book which are a kind of Marxist analysis of the politics of the time. You have sections which are kind of Freudian analysis of Flaubert's inner life and so on. I mean, structurally the whole thing is a mess, but I think, again, it's misunderstood the art of biography, which is one of the things that's central to the art of biography, I think, is selection. You don't write a better biography by including more facts, necessarily.
On ABC Radio National, abc.net.au/rn, you're with the Philosopher's Zone, and I'm talking to Ray Monk about the art of philosophical biography. Now, sadly, we can't hear the voice of Munch's first subject, Ludwig Wittgenstein. Very difficult to imagine anybody getting him into a studio. But we can listen to his next, Bertrand Russell, who didn't die until 1970, when he was 98, and who in 1959 recorded an interview with the BBC.
Well, now, let's turn to your schooling. What sort of learning at that age? Did you, for instance, study the classics?
Well, to a certain degree, I was never fond of the classics. I mean, mathematics was what I liked. My first lesson in mathematics I had from my brother, who started me on Euclid. And I thought it was lovely stuff I'd ever seen in my life. I didn't know there was anything so nice in the world.
Can you remember and tell us about that first lesson?
Oh, yes, I remember it very well. But I remember that it was a disappointment because he said, now we start with axioms. And I said, what are they? And he said, oh, they're things you've got to admit, although we can't prove them. So I said, why should I admit them if you can't prove them? And he said, well, if you won't, we can't go on. And I wanted to see how it went on, so I admitted them pro tem.
Now, what was it that first provided you with the incentive to become a mathematician?
I liked it, for a number of reasons. In the first place, the sheer pleasure, which is the sort that people get from music or from poetry, it delighted me. And then, apart from that, I thought that mathematics was the key to understanding the universe. And I found all sorts of everyday things explained by means of mathematics.
Have you found on the whole in your own life that the pursuit of either mathematics or philosophy has given you some sort of substitute for religious emotion?
Yes, it certainly did. I mean, until I was about 40, I should think, I got the sort of satisfaction that Plato says you can get out of mathematics. It was an eternal world, it was a timeless world. It was a world where there was a possibility of a certain kind of perfection. And I certainly got something analogous to religious satisfaction out of it.
Bertrand Russell. And if that sounds like a tale of first love, that in many respects is what it is. Russell came to adopt a mystical view of mathematics as a realm of eternal truth, which he abandoned only when he read the work of his younger associate, Ludwig Wittgenstein. But he moved in a very different direction to Wittgenstein, and simply couldn't see the point of Wittgenstein's later work. He lived a much longer life too, and he published a huge amount on an enormous variety of subjects, not just philosophy, but politics, history, and education. Intellectually and emotionally, he was all over the place. Does he require a very different sort of approach from the biographer?
Yes, he does. You can't write the kind of book I wrote about Wittgenstein about Russell. I mean, as you say, Wittgenstein was very conveniently monomaniacal. His life was concentrated and he stripped away from his life everything that wasn't necessary. He never owned a house. He never married. He had very few friends. He lived in the simplest kind of way. His entire life was focused on really two things, the attempt to achieve philosophical clarity and the attempt to achieve ethical decency. And the theme of my book was that these were two sides of the same coin and that, you know, one should see them as a unity and so on. And Wittgenstein's life allows one to do that. Russell's life, by comparison, I mean, you know, he married four times, he had countless lovers, Wittgenstein published one book in his lifetime, Russell published 60 books, Wittgenstein published one article, Russell published 2,000 articles. At the Russell Archives in Canada, they've got something like 40,000 letters of Russell's. As you say, he lived a lot longer, but he kept many different strands going. I mean, so in any given week of Russell's life, you've got a political story to tell, a story about political activism, an intellectual story, a story about, you know, what philosophy he's thinking about, what he's writing about. He might be writing some journalism, dealing with his children, dealing with his wives, pursuing affairs. So just on a narrative level, it requires a very different skill.
Ray Munk. Details of his long biography of Wittgenstein and his very long biography of Bertrand Russell, who incidentally he doesn't much approve of as a man, on our website at abc.net.au/rn/philosopherszone. The show's produced by Kyla Slavin with technical production by Charlie McCune. I'm Alan Saunders. More deep thoughts next week.
We hope you enjoyed this ABC Radio National podcast. So, would you like to hear more? At our website, you'll find a wide range of programs that inform and entertain, including By Design. From the cities and buildings we live in, to the cars we drive and the clothes we wear, By Design explores how design reflects social change, the decisions we make as consumers, and what everyday objects tell us about who we are. And you can find By Design to stream or download from the Radio National website.